When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Climate change has no feelings. The realities are what they are. Either you can close your eyes and ears and mouth and refuse to deal with it, or you're just going to have to face facts and say things are not only going to have to change, they are changing.
This is Wicked Problems. I'm Richard Delevan. After years of delay, could today be the day we start requiring companies to disclose their climate risk?
So significant losses in terms of write-downs on balance sheets of stranded assets are already taking place. You can take just a consumer packaged goods brand. They may be taking in, for example, wheat from wholesale. How are they going to know exactly what the actual carbon emissions are from those? They'll estimate it, and that's fine. But are they estimating it in exactly the same way as their peers?
Peter Drucker never actually said what you measure and manage. But there's a reason the saying has stuck around. Measurement, verification, and reporting have been some of the biggest challenges to effective climate action. One thing to put out a glossy sustainability report that'll be read only by a few people, mostly in NGOs. But the idea of businesses having a legal responsibility to disclose how their business is at risk from climate, both physical risk and transition risk, as well as being required to report emissions, has been resisted for decades. Investors, however, increasingly want to know what a company's exposure is. Saltwater intrusion making a whole section of a city's real estate uninhabitable, floods, power outages, changes in crop yields, the Panama Canal drying up and fritzing supply chains, or if governments finally decide to levy a tax on carbon emissions. Not for the feel-good factor, but because it's a material aspect of a company's potential future profitability, which should be a signal for where capital gets allocated. And as the dangerous effects of climate change become more obvious, assessing those risks goes from a nice-to-have to essential in evaluating how to price things like equity or debt. For decades, companies did a lot to try and not have to put their signature on a financial report with that information. Because while the consequences of having an NGO mad at you are bad, getting your climate risk and emissions data wrong starts to look a lot scarier when you're staring down the barrel of a shareholder lawsuit or an investigation with media coverage mentioning things like Enron or Volkswagen. And of course, climate tech and energy companies that are offering more and more powerful tools to measure and manage climate risk and emissions disclosures would have a vast new market created by a standardized set of rules that companies would need to live by. Europe, and even China, have already implemented regulation requiring these kinds of disclosures. But the really big question has, for years, been whether the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, that regulates all publicly traded companies in the United States, would do the same. Businesses have lobbied through a fierce rearguard action to claim it's unworkable and too much of a burden. But after years of delays, the SEC... But after years of delays, the SEC said it would vote on new rules this spring. But the political climate increasingly looked doubtful. A few weeks ago, we spoke to Ryan Skinner at the climate consultancy Verdantix about the topic, and it seemed likely the SEC might even delay until after the election in November. Could be that the SEC commissioners can read a poll and figure this might be the last chance for several years to put these long-delayed rules on the books. Who knows? But it's March 6th, 2024, and the SEC says today's the day. It's going to vote. The consequences for business and the opportunities for climate tech risk firms could be huge. If you do enjoy these conversations, go to news.wickedproblems.uk and sign up to get them into your inbox. Please rate us and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and share this episode with somebody who wants to hear from one of the smartest guys keeping an eye on those opportunities and those challenges, Ryan Skinner from Verdantix. Here's our conversation. Ryan Skinner, head of research at Verdantix for net zero and climate risk. So happy you could join us on the program.
Yeah, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much, Richard.
And this is your first time on Wicked Problems. We do talk about a range of topics, and I suppose we've been trying to get you on the show for a couple months now after seeing some of the work that you're doing around trying to explain the changing landscape around climate disclosures. Maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you came to this.
Sure, yeah, happy to. So I'm the research director at Verdantix on leading the research practice of net zero and climate risk. So just for those who don't know, Verdantix is a market research firm. We have about 100 employees, six research practices, and we advise sustainability, operations, risk, and facilities managers on major decisions that they're needing to make. And so my team focuses on, as I said, net zero and climate risk. So we do research in kind of all topics that fall underneath those. So we get into aspects of carbon management and carbon accounting, as you might imagine, science-based targets. We also are doing research in carbon removals. And then on the climate risk side, we look at solutions to help identify, monitor, and manage physical and transition climate risks. So that's what I'm doing now.
So you're the kind of guy who's going to be calling the balls and strikes, or influence the kind of decisions that a lot of our audience who might be climate tech founders or people working in corporates as part of that effort. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think they're going to be very eager to see what you have to say about different aspects. But I suppose we wanted to talk about how the landscape is changing on disclosure. Mm-hmm. Last year, we saw California pass SB 253, mm-hmm. along with some other bills that you require companies doing business with $1 billion of revenue globally. If they're doing business in California, they have to disclose everything, including their scope 3 emissions. Mm-hmm. We had in Europe coming into force earlier this month, where we're speaking on the 30th of Jan, the Corporate Sustainability Disclosure or Reporting Directive, I think, mm-hmm. which, and weirdly, the sky has not fallen, despite some of the lobbying against it. So tell us a little bit about like how things have changed, why these disclosure requirements are coming into place now.
Yeah, I would say the whole underpinning is, of course, the amount of financing that's going to need to be mobilized in order to fund the climate transition. I think it's recognized that we're talking billions, if not trillions of dollars and euros and yen and everything else is going to have to move over into kind of different forms of transition financing, sustainable financing, and so on and so forth. And there's been a space that has been trying to invest in that for quite some time with its own particular foibles and risks and challenges, that is the broader kind of ESG investing space. And it's been recognized that these investors, if they're going to make a significant impact, they need to have good insight into what it is that they're actually investing in. So they need clear, ideally comparable disclosures in order to make good decisions. And I guess I think Michael Bloomberg's effort with the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures really brought this to a head and said, okay, now let's clarify what is it that investors would actually need, and developed, of course, their recommendations for that. And that led to a whole range of different jurisdictions taking up this banner. So New Zealand, for example, has adopted it. Many different countries have adopted something that is either TCFD or some interpretation of TCFD. Now, the European Union has, of course, been acting and progressing on this front as well, relatively quickly, developing their own taxonomy and of course, passing the CSRD. So they here in the continent have very ambitious, or there in the continent, I guess I should say, have very ambitious targets that they're talking about cutting 90% of their greenhouse gas emissions by 2040 now. So very clear about the challenges in front of them, and feel that these disclosures are going to help to facilitate that.
Okay. And it's something that I suppose when Bloomberg and Mark Carney and a lot of other actors were raising the profile of climate-related risks as well as disclosure of emissions, mm-hmm. Things do seem to have, I suppose, accelerated in the sense that the insurance industry last year started to tot up some very scary numbers in terms of just U.S. only kind of damage from extreme weather events that can be attributed to with a higher chance of them happening due to climate change. So it's become a real financial issue in a way that people did expect, but maybe didn't expect to happen this soon.
Yeah, it certainly has. I mean, if you just look at the property casualty market and the amount of losses that they're showing in the past couple of years, it's certainly adding up. I think there's an attribution challenge, though, really. There's so many things that are happening around the world that impacts supply chains, from obviously significant agricultural collapses here and there, and it isn't actually often bubbling up into corporate reporting. It gets filed as different operational challenges, supply chain challenges. There are a lot of things that essentially derive from a climate change related cause that aren't actually getting attributed to the climate, which creates an environment where people can continue a bit with business as usual when, in fact, there's a lot of risk there. And so, not surprisingly, the UN has been repeatedly flagging this as a significant risk and thing that businesses and everyone needs to be on top of. But yeah, there is that challenge of people not moving fast enough. In fact, one of the things that we found in our research is that for business leaders, they should have their eyes very much on physical risk, but it's transition risk that probably has their attention the most. And I mean, when you see what's happened with the electric vehicle space and how in countries where there's a significant penetration of electric vehicles, businesses, well, like Tesla, but increasingly the Chinese automakers are going to displace the big legacy automakers. It's, if I was an automaker in the EU or in the US, that would have my attention very much. I have no doubt they've been seeing decks from their risk teams for a decade already warning them of this. But now suddenly it's real. But that reality is going to be coming to more and more industries.
I mean, I wanted to explore that a little bit more, because I do think there is this lack of understanding about the counter pressure. When people stand up at COP and they talk about we're going to treble renewables and we're going to displace internal combustion engines and we're going to pass all sorts of things that phase them out in some way. But if you're sitting on top of a balance sheet where you own tens of billions worth of natural gas distribution networks, or you've spent a career designing ICE engines, vehicles, then suddenly that expertise is no longer worth anything. And suddenly your gas network isn't worth what you thought it was, which then has a downstream impact in terms of immediately for you, your bonus, your employability, or the employees who work for the firm, or indeed the book value of the assets, for the entire company. Mm-hmm. And I think many people don't understand, like, these stakes are real. And people are going to fight pretty hard to not put their hand up and say, yeah, these things are things that we should be worried about because they're now a material risk to the value of the company. So do you think it's impossible for me not to have sympathy, I suppose, with people who are just faced with this choice, want to put that off as long as possible?
Yeah, sure. We can sympathize at the same time. And so you really, as an individual leader, need to try to find what is going to be the place where I'm going to have most significant impact here, and understand that, and then act based upon it. But yeah, it's sure, have sympathy, but at the same time, take that sympathy and then encourage growth and development.
But I suppose and this sets up the backdrop for this fight that's going on mostly behind closed doors, in the States, where the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates publicly traded companies and what they have to tell investors before they put their money in. So going back to 2022, they've been discussing changing the rules about what we call scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3 emissions disclosure, as well as climate-related risk, whether physical or transition. So first, can you say a little bit about what the proposed rule, as we understand it, is meant to do? And then we might talk a little bit about what you're putting your kind of forecasting hat on, what you think, what we will wind up getting if we get something at all this year. So first of all, what's it about?
Yeah, it's very similar to really what's been they're pushing at in the European Union and have done in the UK as well. It's to force large businesses to incorporate in their financial accounting and reporting indications of their climate performance and the climate risks that face the business so that the investor community can act with information and on a comparable basis firm to firm and make smart decisions about how they allocate their capital. So that is the underlying demand and desire. The challenge, of course, is different perceptions within the U.S. political environment about the role of executive branch agencies in policymaking. So I think it was the EPA which ran up against the Supreme Court's major decisions argument that the EPA didn't have a right to create policy or determine how power plants would report or create emissions. So, mm-hmm. So there are different interpretations of that, and there is even people on the SEC board. While it seems that the overarching, I think Gensler and the rest of people who are leading this role seem to be for the reporting. There's certainly people within the SEC as well who are against it. The comment period for the SEC's proposed disclosure rules all the way back in summer 2022 produced hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments, many of them critical and many of them challenging the issues, especially around Scope 3 reporting, indicating that it was essentially very diffuse, poorly defined accounting. It was going to lead to a lot of error, confusion, a lot of people having to invest tremendous amounts of money to try to get on top of it, and the sense that this was a waste of time, essentially, for businesses and wouldn't actually help contribute to better decision making. So I think that's been an ongoing thing. And of course, then we've had just a series of delays. And so we're at a point now where we're in a bit of a purgatory and not knowing when this is going to resolve, but suspecting it probably won't resolve at least in the next 9 months.
Right. So that's interesting. So you think that because of the delays, and we're now into a political season in the U.S., which is only going to ramp up in its intensity.
Yeah.
So is it your guess the SEC is going to just not touch it during this period?
Yeah, they have set April 2024, so 3 months from now, as the date by which they're going to formalize these rules. But they also said April 2023 and October 2023, and so it's reasonable to have doubt and worry, like, are they actually going to accomplish it this time? And you have to think, given what I just described about the different interpretations and how that is reflected politically, what's the likelihood that they would then go ahead and formalize only 3-4 months before a presidential election? So it'd be almost like waving a red rag in front of a bull. I don't know.
Well, that said, I suppose I was surprised. I'm listening at the moment this week to Baker Hughes, one of the oilfield services companies, and regular listeners will know, full disclosure, ex-client, who have their annual meeting in Florence at the moment. And the only topic being talked about is the decision to potentially pause approvals of new export terminals for liquefied natural gas, which has built up as a big campaign to try and identify the real carbon impact of LNG, very different from what we might have thought 10 years ago, and that they're scrambling to figure out how do we respond to this. So I think that, who knows? I mean, I guess many people were surprised that in an election year that the Biden administration would in fact decide to go down that path. So I guess we'll see. But if it does go through, I mean, why does it matter? I mean, so just to...
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Take a step back. For those people who are not completely au fait with Scope 3, what is it and why would businesses, you know, want desperately to have it not be part of their requirements to disclose?
So Scope 3 emissions are your value chain emissions. It's all those emissions that you don't create directly from either some, like your boilers or your plants burning fossil fuels, or power plants that supply you with electricity burning fossil fuels. But essentially, the products you make creating burning fossil fuels, like automakers, or the fossil fuels that are created as your inputs are generated. And so there's 15 different categories to them that live within the greenhouse gas protocol. But it is, for most businesses, the lion's share of their actual emissions footprint. So for many businesses, it'll easily be 70, 80, 90% of their emissions. You can take, for example, financial services companies. So category 15 are your financed emissions. So the emissions generated by essentially your investments. And you can only imagine for like a Citibank or something, it's going to be 90+% So it is the lion's share of business, most businesses' emissions. The challenges around it is, of course, accounting for those emissions. At a high level, a Citibank could say, yeah, we know. So it's certainly our category 15. And they could probably do a very grove or rough estimate and say, okay, we know of those 90% Pareto principle, 80% are coming from these very 20% of our investments, which we know are massively emitting. Then like power plants and steel producers and things like that. But when you want, if you're going to actually decide that you want to get down into every little gram ton of carbon, it becomes very complex because for large enterprises, they have very sophisticated, complex, multi-tiered supply chains. Those supply chains are not accustomed to reporting on this. You can take just a consumer packaged goods brand. They may be taking in, for example, wheat from wholesale. How are they going to know exactly what the actual carbon emissions are from those? They'll estimate it, and that's fine. But are they estimating it in exactly the same way as their peers? What if the two are estimating it in a slightly different way? Well, then how is the whole idea of comparability then maintained if you're each estimating in very different ways? And that's how some of the academic research on this has arrived, that given those variances in how things are estimated and totted up and calculated, leads to oftentimes radically different final numbers. And so from an investor perspective, the notion that you're looking at apples to apples is lost. And that makes the whole parade float come off its wheels.
And so is the rule that's being has been mulled over for 2 years now. I mean, is the rule meant to address that uncertainty, to provide this kind of apples to apples comparison so that investors could just look and see? And how technical is it going to get in terms of being prescriptive about how you calculate this stuff?
Well, that's I guess the challenge. I mean, the many of the existing rules haven't been terribly prescriptive. Even the TCFD didn't get into any particular detail about how a Scope 3 inventory would be calculated. You can look in the greenhouse gas protocol, and it's specific, but not very explicit. You can still choose your different forms of estimation. There's any number of emissions factors you can use, which translate grams of a product towards tons of emissions. And so that doesn't exist. The European Union is probably pushing furthest in terms of being very explicit about these kinds of things. So they have established the European Sustainability Reporting Standards, which will be probably as explicit as we'll see. And those are still being developed, as far as I understand. But this expectations the SEC would not typically be as prescriptive, which then again, challenges what's the value of it if it's going to be not an apples to apples comparison, and might make an argument for chucking it out altogether.
In terms of what you're hearing from your clients and the research that you're doing, obviously we have had this now happen in Europe, not here in the UK where I'm sitting, but in Europe we've had this directive come in. People have been gearing up to get ready for that. I hear a lot more about farmers in France worried about Ukrainian wheat coming in to depress commodity prices, but I've not heard a lot of pushback on this particular point. Are people just getting on with it here on this side of the Atlantic?
Yeah, basically. It's all the reporting wheels are turning, and all the parties that need to create these reports are getting under the desk and sharpening their pencils and getting on with it as best they can, right? So ultimately, the kind of product, the reports will be made. They will be filed. Whether they have the intended effect or value is something that we'll see at the end of the day. For the time being, there are no explicit, specific like requirements. Nobody's going to be punished per se for, I mean, provided you're actually giving, sorry, lost my screen for a second. Provided you actually can account for how you've calculated things, that will be sufficient. So there's not a huge amount of risk on that front. Ultimately, they probably will get more and more strict as far as that goes. But yeah, for the time being, people are just going to get on with it. They're going to make their reports. And that's what's happening right now.
So it seems obvious if you're a lobbyist for an industry or for a particular large company, you're going to, you know, want to advocate on behalf of your client, minimize administrative burden, costs, whatever else. But where are the winners in this? I mean, who are the sectors or even the kind of innovators who might be people who benefit from these rule changes?
Well, sure. The SEC actually was required to estimate how much consulting hours would go into a rules change. And I mean, it was a massive number. It was, I mean,
nice.
So you can imagine all the consultancies that feed into this, provided, for example, the SEC rule goes through, we'll obviously see a significant large new revenue source come online. In the European Union, that's already taking place. So on the part of people who help large businesses with corporate carbon accounting, for example, and that kind of thing, this is a major business. And then there is, of course, different technologies and softwares and digital solutions that help businesses with this on an ongoing basis, either on the carbon accounting side or on aspects of climate risk calculation and so on. So they stand to benefit. The question becomes how much and how quickly do the large businesses decide to invest in kind of that significant architecture investment that takes place. We're certainly seeing some first movers do this. So talking to large chemicals companies, for example, or large manufacturers who clearly see the writing on the wall, are pressed by not only CSRD, but also the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism and recognize that actually we need to get on top of this whole piece. They're certainly making moves and progressing in this way and building architecture. But those are two parties who are certainly keen to see this happen. And of course, also suffer every time it gets delayed because suddenly deals slow down, stop altogether and that kind of thing.
Right. But I suppose that the overall direction of travel, we are heading into a very different kind of environment. You already mentioned the U.S. political scene. Around the world, we're having a lot of people who are putting their hand up and saying, maybe this whole green thing, this whole net zero thing has just gone too far, whether here in the UK or the upcoming European Parliament elections, or indeed the very scary US presidential election that'll be coming up. Mm-hmm. So are you more optimistic or pessimistic in terms of that the direction of travel will remain the same, even despite any kind of short-term perturbations about this? If corporates just going to continue to make these investments, and once they're made, stick with it?
Yeah, I mean, I am optimistic, I suppose a bit pessimistic in the short term, optimistic in the longer term. It'll work itself out eventually. I'm heartened by, for example, an interesting story I saw out of Australia. Of course, they had the terrible fires and they also had floods, but then there was an election. And during that election, the parties that leaned in towards reducing Australia's exposure to carbon and who wanted to deal with climate risk did well, and those who didn't did more poorly. And there's been just a tremendous amount of climate action after that in the past year or so out of Australia. So that is certainly a positive sign. As I said, there's no arguing with the climate. It is a scientific system that responds to physical inputs, and so it will continue to do its thing. And so hopefully, presumably, eventually, the populations will respond by input political pressure on leaders to make significant changes. I'm not a huge believer in the thinking that investors are going to save us and just investor disclosure is going to save us. I think that the governments actually need to institute more aggressive legislation that makes emissions costly. And without that, you won't have the significant and really radical changes that are required to prevent some pretty bad things from happening around the world.
And I suppose we're not anticipating that being one of your predictions for this year. So you have a pretty good track record, as I understand it, in terms of your 2023 predictions, where you had a good batting average in terms of things coming true on methane, on requirements for people with particular skills in the year being hired by European companies. So tell us a little bit about some of the predictions you had for 2024.
Sure. So we live, the nature of our research lives very much between kind of the buyers and sellers that I described. So the sellers being the consultancies and software companies I mentioned who stand to gain from a lot of this, and buyers being the corporate buyers and sustainability leaders, as I mentioned. And so a lot of our discussion, our research, and our predictions fall right in between those two in order to help both parties better understand each other, basically. So we do 10 predictions every year. I'd shared, I think, three in a blog post. And I'll try to make sure I can touch on maybe a couple that we find quite interesting. So one of our predictions is that insurers will launch climate-related parametric products for energy and logistics industries. So this parametric insurance space is one that has been growing. And by parametric insurance here, we're talking about insurance policies that pay out based on an event's magnitude as opposed to the losses incurred. What that does is it allows payments to get across to policyholders faster. And it is, as you can imagine, a scenario with acute physical climate risks, allows businesses to potentially, for example, make preventive investments as opposed to always just fixing up the damage after it's occurred and that kind of thing. So we do expect, so insurers, as we mentioned, are taking the climate change challenge here on the nose. And so they're going to be pushing for more of these kinds of products in order to forestall worse and worse types of damages. And then in the areas where we expect to see that become most prevalent in terms of their development and their innovation, we expect to see with like oil and gas and transport and logistics types of companies. So that's one thing that we predict will take off in 2024.
Okay. So I think a couple of the others that you had in your blog post, I mean, one was on nature-focused software startups getting $100 million in capital this year. So that's, I think, self-explanatory. Tell me a little bit about the second one that you had, which was on technical climate skills and how you're seeing that ramp up in terms of demand for people with a skill set. First of all, what are technical climate skills? And like you made a comparison with the dawn of the digital transformation era being a big thing 20 years ago. So what's that about?
Yeah, so I mean, technical climate skills are the ability to understand core underlying climate data, climate models, and understand how they can be applied to understand business risks. One of the things that we talk about is that intersection, somebody with these kinds of technical skills in terms of understanding underlying climate science, that combined with an MBA is like the business unicorn today. They just barely exist. There's people with these deep client science expertise, and there's people with obviously business expertise, but the two seldom overlap. So we did some really fascinating research last year where we looked at the kind of climate skills space. And one of my analysts found that in many of the major markets like the UK and in Europe, there was essentially more open positions being advertised for people with climate expertise than there were actual climate professionals currently in the market. So you can only imagine what that means. Essentially, most businesses just do not have the capabilities that they need in order to meet the climate challenge. And so one of the things that we're going to see more and more of, and you hear this from sustainability leaders, many that I've spoken with, it's like within our team, fine, we can bring in some client science experts, we can have those technical climate skills, but actually they need to be put to work throughout the organization. You need procurement people to actually understand this type of stuff and what it means and incorporate it into the actual way they work. Without that happening, none of these things are going to we're not going to make much progress, essentially. And so as a result, we've seen first movers, obviously the big consultancies are investing heavily in their own training. We see more and more training programs pop up, but we expect this to become really more and more popular throughout this year and come to a head where, technical climate skills are going to be top five in terms of training programs in our point of view.
Well, I suppose to get more of these nuggets of wisdom and predictions for 2024, people need to sign up for some of the research products at Verdantix. So that's a little plug for the product there.
Thank you.
Listen, I've kept you over time, so I really appreciate your patience with us. So I guess before we close, I just wanted to ask everybody who comes on to the show to, if they can offer any insights about things that influenced them and got them interested in working in some of these topics. So anything that jumps to mind that influenced you at any point during your kind of working life or earlier?
Sure. I would say, so I started my research in the kind of broader ESG space while I was still an analyst at Forrester. And as an analyst, you often appreciate contrarian voices, people who are willing to shout the truth or their truth in the face of what they believe is a lot of hocus pocus and clouds and shadows. And for that reason, when I was doing that research, I found that the voice of Tariq Fancy was really remarkable and interesting and valuable. He obviously had come from a background within BlackRock and leading the responsible investment group within BlackRock, but very quickly became disillusioned with the whole ESG game and very quickly started talking about how he felt it was a mirage and we were fooling ourselves in terms of what we were actually accomplishing there, that many ESG investments were essentially not leading to anything of value in terms of the underpinning things that people thought that they were investing in. And he continues, he's left BlackRock, which is what has allowed him to probably say a lot of these things, but he continues to do interesting work and continues to have an interesting point of view. So that's it's a good source. And usually the people he links to as well on LinkedIn, for example, I found very valuable. So that'd be a tip of mine.
Fascinating. All right. Well, we'll check that out. Put that in the show notes as well as some of the other things, including your blog post. Anything else that you'd like to mention before we close?
No, just that it's been a pleasure to join you here on the Wicked Problems podcast. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Richard. And anyone has questions or anything they'd like to discuss, happy to talk further.
Ryan Skinner, Research Director at Verdantix for Net Zero and Climate Risk. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
Thanks for listening to Wicked Problems. And if you like this conversation, please share it and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps people find the show. You can subscribe to our newsletter at news.wickedproblems.uk, where you could also find more episodes with Richard Delvin and Claire Brady and all our show notes. And consider becoming a paid subscriber to help support our work. You can also find us wherever you get your podcasts. For now, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.